Okay, next about counseling and psychotherapy with Mark Holcomb and Lauren Elliott, so in case you're wrong, please. Admission is by name tag or ticket only. Important for the sinking or sailing of someone. My name is R.A. Jepson. It's my job to make sure it starts on time and ends on time and make sure nobody killed anybody. I can do that last of this. It was really fascinating to talk to Mark Coco on the phone to get his information so that I could introduce him. Very interesting man. I could talk to him for a long time. He's a doctoral candidate in counseling and psychology at New York University. He has a master's degree at Fordham University in New York City. He's a bachelor of science in psychology at Haverford College in Philadelphia. That's the boring stuff. Interesting stuff that he wears 11.5 size shoe. I told him to tell me interesting stuff. That's what he started out with, so I figured he deserved this. He said he's a child of the 60s, a native of Greenwich Village, and that he really sets him apart. I've never met a native of Greenwich Village, even though I've lived there a few times in my life. And he said he was a hippie before it was hip. And a Catholic when Mass was still said in Latin. And I've never heard this expression before, but it certainly fits Utah. He said he got his first lift leads in his life when he came to a missionary training center in the dry weather of Provo, Utah. And then I pictured, oh yeah, I understand what you mean after he said that, because I just think it was part of my life that I didn't let my lips get cracked. That was preparatory to serving the mission in the Japan Yokohama mission. He said as soon as he got home, he rededicated himself to growing his beard back. No reflection on his dedication to the church. He has since served in two districts and on one high council. And if you're impressed by awards, please be impressed now because he's got lots of another awards already. I think he'll probably be getting more. Today's presentation is from a work in progress on the introduction to counseling and psychology for LDS clients. The special interest is in how religious culture affects psychology and psychotherapy. And because this person moves fast, I presume to keep up with his intellect, please be aware that Mr. Colco is no longer, as of 2 weeks ago, at Manhattanville College. He's in private practice and does consulting. Commenting on his paper will be Moyne Oviatt. She has a Bachelor of Science degree at BYU in psychology, a master's degree from the University of Utah in social work, and she's in private practice in Salt Lake City. And for me, the most important thing about, interesting thing about Moyne is that in 1982, when I first started going to Sunstone Symposiums, I had 5 very small children. I was over 40 and completely maxed out and totally stressed out in my life, and came to a Sunstone just because I happened to be downtown that day trying to hide from the babysitter and my children because I was completely bonkers. Heard a paper given at Sunstone at the University or at the Hotel Utah that I thought was really very good. But I was sitting here like this. And mine got out and point by point totally tore that paper to shreds. And I realized that I hadn't been thinking in years, that I had not thought a single original thought since I started having babies. And it was like a breath of fresh air to find out that I could think like she was thinking and still be a good Mormon and still be satisfied with myself. So Sunstone, it became a great breathing space from then on for my life. Even though I'd known Moyne in the Singles Ward trenches and watched her for many years, it was that particular moment in time that I remember her for. So, and the other thing that I really appreciate about Moyne is that she has the courage to be starting to raise two little babies after she's 40. I think she's quite young, certainly not younger than I am when I started having babies. So I think you're going to be in for a real wonderful treat today. I'll let her tell you what she told me the phone about Mark's paper.
Moyne just mentioned to me to be brave. I'll try that. Thank you very much for your introduction. I'd like to start off about describing a few people I know who are in really deep pain. I'll start off with a fellow I'll call John. When I first came to know him, he was deeply depressed and felt that there was no chance that he would get better. He felt worthless, unworthy, and vile, and held the opinion that the world would be better off without him. Occasionally, his depression would lift, only to return again, but at one point, this roller coaster ride became too much to handle. He went to a secluded spot, strapped his belt to a tree limb, and attempted to hang himself. What saved him was that the tree limb broke, which was quite fortunate, both for him and for his wife and for his children. I'll call another person Jane. She, too, held a very low opinion of herself, but for a different reason than John. She had been sexually abused as a child by family members on many occasions. She felt that for this reason, she was unworthy before God and would be better off dead. It was only with great effort that I was able to extract from her a promise not to commit suicide within the first 3 month period that we worked together in therapy. But I was only able to get that promise by explaining the consequences which her suicide would have on her child. I'll call this next couple Jim and Julie. They did not have dramatic symptoms, they didn't have dramatic backgrounds, but they were very unhappy. After more than 10 years of marriage, they found it impossible to live with one another. They argued, they threw things, they were miserable. One of them thought of a divorce, which the other one completely ruled out, even without an open discussion of their difficulties. Their children knew that something was very wrong in their home. Now, they're not really named John or Jane or Jim or Julie, but I have really met with them in the course of my practice in counseling and psychotherapy. All of these people are Latter-day Saints. Most of my LDS clients have been active, have testimonies, and strive to fulfill their callings. Now, people like this can probably benefit from the experience of counseling and psychotherapy, and they'd be in very good company. Let's consider a typical LDS ward of, say 200 adults, is that fair? 200 adults. Over the course of any six-month period, we would expect 14 people in this ward to suffer from some kind of anxiety disorder, such as a tendency to panic attacks, obsessive thoughts, compulsive actions, phobias. 7 to 12 of the people in this ward would suffer from a serious mood disorder, such as major depression. Please keep in mind that this is during the course of any six-month period. The long-range forecast is another story. At some time during the course of their lives, about 20% of all American adults will experience an anxiety disorder, a mood disorder, or some other very serious mental or social or emotional disorder. And I'm not including people who have disorders associated with substance abuse. I'm not including people with marital difficulties. I'm also not including people with psychosexual difficulties, which will afflict one adult in four at some point over the course of their lives. Although many Latter-day Saints could benefit from therapy, we lay a particular burden on this subject. Many people in our society carry misconceptions about therapy, but Mormons hold mistaken ideas which are peculiar to LDS culture. It's because of these misunderstandings that Mormons prevent themselves from receiving the benefits which therapy has to offer. My presentation will consider six of the mistaken ideas, or myths, which Latter-day Saints have about counseling and psychotherapy. My objective is to give you a less distorted view of therapy. And I'll hope that if you or someone you know is faced with certain kinds of difficulties, that perhaps therapy will become a real option. Because as it is now, many Latter-day Saints rule out therapy even when it would be most helpful. The first myth that I would like to consider is something I call the myth of invincible righteousness. Now, you've heard this kind of thing before. People say things like, oh, we have the true gospel. The answers to all problems can be found in the gospel. So outside counseling and psychotherapy aren't necessary if people are living the gospel as they should. Mormons tend to feel that if they live their religion, they should never need therapy. Mormons often feel that the gospel should be enough, and that if the saint goes to therapy, this is a denial of the power of the faith. On the surface of it, this myth sounds plausible. Mormons do believe that the gospel is a comprehensive guide to life, which provides a powerful set of tools for dealing with life's difficulties. It's tempting to believe that if we're having trouble dealing with our problems, well, this means that we simply haven't been trying hard enough to live the gospel. As this line of thought goes, if we read our scriptures more, went to our meetings, attended the temple, fasted, did our home and visiting teaching, and especially, we prayed more regularly and with more devotion, we'd be able to deal with our problems. This sounds like a theologically safe way to deal with personal challenges. The problem is that it's not true under many circumstances. The basic principles of personal spirituality have a purpose. That purpose is to help us to turn from sin to God and attain salvation, period. The basic practices of personal spirituality are not meant primarily to prevent disasters, put bread on the table, fix the car, or cure depression. Gospel living does not infallibly prevent the occurrence of mental or emotional disorders or problems in living. It is true that the practice of gospel living may make us more effective in our everyday lives. But even people who live the gospel have their investments go south, have flat tires, lose their jobs, get cancer, and have obsessional thoughts. Gospel living is not some kind of shield that protects us infallibly from serious personal problems. And to think that it is some kind of infallible shield is to believe not in the gospel. That's to believe in magic, and in a very low form of magic at that. It's entirely possible that a person can live the gospel to the fullest extent possible, and yet he or she may still be the victim of some kind of emotional difficulty or personal challenge for which therapy or counseling would be quite useful. I've spoken about prevention. Gospel living is not an infallible cure, either, for mental or emotional difficulties once they occur. It's true that the mere practice of personal spirituality can bring about miracles. Fasting may bring rain. Prayer may restart the car, as Eugene Englund will tell you. Prayer may cure the physical, emotional, or spiritual ailment. But we're not supposed to seek after signs or miracles. We're to use the resources available to us to the fullest extent possible. I'm reminded of, now I'm not a pioneer child, okay? My pioneer forebears were the people who left Poland to come to New York and stayed there. But I am still reminded of Brigham Young's response when he heard of the tribulations of the Martin Handcart Company, which had been caught in early winter storms while attempting to reach Deseret, and they're probably descendants of that company here today. President Young dismissed the day's Sabbath meetings and sent the saints home to arrange for food and care for the survivors, rather than stay in their meetings and pray. As he put it, prayer is good, but when baked potatoes and milk are needed, prayer will not supply their place. But in a very similar way, when professional intervention is needed, in the case of someone who is suffering, prayer or any other element of personal spirituality will not do as a substitute. In other words, it's the way that Marlene Payne, who's an LDS psychiatrist, put it, and I quote, "The teachings of the church cannot banish personality problems. They can only offer a program for achieving maturity." Unquote. Yes, the gospel encompasses all truth. Therapy is not meant to be a substitute for the gospel any more than plumbing or accounting or auto repair or any other practical art or science is supposed to be a substitute for religion. Therapy is a set of technologies, in one sense. It's a set of techniques and methods, and it is a very special relationship between two people, between the therapist and the client, or between more than two people in a group situation, which has the specific purpose of enhancing the client's life. In this sense, a therapist is much like a dietitian, an athletic trainer, or a physician. Turning to one of these professionals is not a denial of the power of the Mormon faith. And turning to a therapist is not such a denial either. I feel that underlying the myth of invincible righteousness, there are two things people are scared about. First, I think that many saints fear that therapy will somehow endanger their testimony, and so they feel it's necessary to defend the gospel by devaluing therapy. I deal a little later with this myth that therapy will endanger the testimonies of people. But secondly, the saints, like people in general, are a bit leery about therapy because it deals with delicate and frankly scary issues. Therapy deals with our personalities, with the sense of who we are. When it comes to our thoughts and our emotions, anything powerful enough to help us is also powerful enough to harm us, maybe powerful enough to destroy us. How can one trust a fallible human being to fiddle around with somebody's mind or soul? When faced with this fear, it's natural to seek help from people who, as we believe, have the special privilege of receiving revelation from God for other people. And I'm talking about the priest of mind authority. This leads me to consider my second myth. I call this the myth of the in-house counseling staff. It's phrased this way. We have bishops and other priesthood leaders to handle all our counseling needs. These men are entitled to receive revelation from God on behalf of the members under their stewardship, so we should trust solely in their guidance rather than rely on the word of a so-called professional. Well, I too believe that bishops and others can receive revelation to meet the needs of the people under their stewardships. But the myth of the in-house counseling staff illustrates a serious misunderstanding of church policy and the role of the bishop. Church policy encourages bishops to find local resources for counseling and therapy to which they can make appropriate referrals when that's necessary. Local leaders are specifically encouraged to find counselors and therapists who can provide a supportive atmosphere for LDS beliefs and values. On the very evening when I was writing these words in the presentation, I was contacted by a unit leader in a stake in northern New Jersey who was concerned about a troubled individual in his congregation. Being aware of when and where to make a referral to outside counseling and therapy is a part of the very responsibility of being a bishop. I have served in two bishoprics and on a high council, and I'm telling you the plain black and white handbook and instructional material truth. Bishops are spiritual advisors. Most of the time, they are not also car mechanics, refrigerator repairmen, or therapy professionals. It is not demeaning to the office of a bishop to seek professional help when it is called for in any area of life. Frankly, it's not demeaning to the office of a bishop for the bishop to seek help for himself or his family in any area of life like this. Separation. Now, it's true that therapy presents a special case. Where does spiritual guidance leave off and therapy begin? Because the truth is that often, and maybe even usually, a person who has concerns which are appropriate for therapy also has appropriate concerns for spiritual guidance. Life does not divide up neatly into therapy concerns and spiritual concerns in a separate box. It's often useful to approach a given problem from several different angles at the same time. For example, depression not only has psychological aspects, but it has physical aspects and spiritual ones as well. Let's take the instance of a person with bipolar disorder, which is more popularly known as manic depression. It's often appropriate for such a person to meet with the bishop for spiritual guidance, to meet with a psychotherapist for counseling and therapy, and to meet with a psychiatrist for a program of medication. One-stop shopping simply doesn't make sense for many spiritual, emotional, and mental disorders. In many cases, it's not a matter of choosing between a bishop and a therapy professional. It's really a matter of collaboration with the bishop and the therapy professional. One does not take the place of the other. They each speak, although they do so in harmony in the best of cases. Now I'd like to focus on a third myth, which is about therapy professionals themselves. What I call the myth of the ungodly therapist runs along these lines. Psychotherapists are anti-religious. non-LDS psychotherapists are particularly anti-religious, unquote. This is simply not true as a blanket statement for most therapists, although, of course, there are prominent anti-religious therapists. Sigmund Freud was well known for his attitude that religion as a guide to life was an illusion. More recently, Albert Ellis has characterized deeply held religious beliefs, what he calls dogmatic beliefs, as psychologically unhealthy. And it's also true that these two gentlemen, as examples, have had a large influence on therapy. Psychoanalysis, which is largely the work of Freud, at least until recently, had a decidedly anti-religious tilt. It was not uncommon in earlier years for psychoanalysts to use devout religious belief only to explain mental illness, not to explain healthy development. And rational emotive therapy, which is largely the work of Ellis, often shows a similar slant. But there's still no reason to issue a blanket denunciation of psychotherapists as anti-religious. It's true that compared to the population at large, therapists show lower rates of conventional religious affiliation and participation. But there is still a substantial amount of spirituality and religious involvement, as demonstrated by a recent national survey. 41% of the psychotherapists surveyed stated that they were regular attenders of religious services. I can't say that for every ward I've lived in. 77% said that they agreed with the statement, "I try hard to live my life according to my religious beliefs." I've served as a high priest group leader, and I don't know that I could have said that about all my high priests. A similar percentage. 46% said that they agreed with the statement, "My whole approach to life is based on my religion." In another recent survey, only 28% of the therapists agreed with the statement that the notions of God or the transcendent are illusory products of human imagination. It simply doesn't make sense in the face of these findings to characterize the mass of psychotherapists as anti-religious. In fact, there is a growing movement among psychotherapists to insist that therapists must strive for an empathic understanding of their clients' religious beliefs. Alan Bergen is an LDS psychologist on faculty at BYU. He published an article entitled "Psychotherapy and Religious Values" in a prominent, very prestigious professional journal. He received about 1,000 requests for reprints. The American Psychological Association has a thriving division of psychologists interested in religious issues. The American Association for Counseling and Development has a similar active division called the Association for Religious and Values Issues in Counseling. One of the most prominent psychoanalysts of 1990 is a Jesuit priest. An issue of the journal Psychotherapy, which is a prominent professional journal, was recently devoted to the topic of psychotherapy and religion, and by far, the treatment given to religion in the articles there was sympathetic. As far as LDS counselors go, my experience is that the members of the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists, also known as AMCAP, are as fine and upstanding members of the church as anywhere else. And I'm a member of the church, largely through the example of one of the members of that organization. I would not wish to present to you an overly optimistic picture. Many non-LDS therapists have no belief or participation. Many LDS therapists are not particularly participating, although that is certainly a group in the minority. And the training of most therapists gives little or no preparation for dealing with the client's religious or spiritual issues. Occasionally, one still does run into an anti-religious therapist. But this then becomes a matter of evaluating potential therapists on a case-by-case basis and not as a class. Part to the myth of the ungodly therapist. And this version of the myth claims that even if therapists are not anti-religious, still they may encourage clients to engage in some kind of behavior which violates LDS moral standards. This does occasionally happen. I have known of situations, for example, where a non-LDS therapist has suggested that a client have an extramarital affair. And I have no intent of condoning this kind of professional behavior. But here again, this is not typical of the profession. There is something typical of the profession, though, which is very easy for LDS clients to misinterpret and take the wrong way. What is typical is that therapists will investigate their clients' standards, not to change them and not to test them, but to discover not only what they are, but how the client really feels about them. That might mean asking the client, for example, have you ever wanted to have an affair? It's a far cry from suggesting one. In addition, it's part of the way most professionals conduct therapy that they listen to whatever their clients bring up without very much open emotional reaction. LDS clients sometimes mistakenly look at the therapist as a sort of secular bishop, and they make a mistake here when they don't get an overt emotional reaction. As Louis G. Mensch has put it, quote, the patient may misinterpret as approval. The psychiatrist who listens without passing judgment or without falling off his chair in shocked amazement or disapproval. Recognition and study of what might be the patient's irresponsible behavior as a step in learning more about himself and learning more mature control may be mistaken for forgiveness or encouragement of the irresponsible behavior, unquote. It is important then for clients to understand that investigating feelings about real or imagined behavior is not the same thing as encouraging that behavior. It's also important for clients to understand that in therapy one may investigate feelings about even very sacred things, and that does not mean that the therapist will ridicule those things. There's another area in which LDS clients may feel unsafe, especially around the non-LDS therapist. This is the area of personal spiritual experience and revelation. For example, suppose you tell your therapist that you've received personal guidance from God, or suppose you felt the presence of the Spirit, or have had a vision, or been involved in a healing, or in some other kind of very special spiritual experience, and you bring this up in therapy. Now, will your therapist nod, and hit that secret button under the desk that calls those very big orderlies to come in and take you away and hear some silence? No, probably not. Again, there are individual therapists who may treat spiritual experiences as evidence of mental illness. But I am surprised by the extent to which non-LDS therapists who have no experience with Mormonism whatsoever are willing to treat personal spiritual experiences with respect. Even the American Psychiatric Association is trying to set a decent example here. Regarding the task of making a diagnosis of schizophrenia, for example, this is what the official psychiatric diagnostic manual has to say. And I quote, beliefs or experiences of members of religious or other cultural groups may be difficult to distinguish from delusions or hallucinations. When such experiences are shared and accepted by a cultural group, they should not be considered evidence of psychosis. It's not as far as I'd like them to go, but it's a start. End quote, incidentally, earlier on. Now, this does not mean that the typical therapist will believe you when you say that the Lord has revealed to you that the church is true. But it is entirely possible that the therapist will not think you're crazy and will accept the idea that from some source, perhaps from deep within yourself, you received a message that works for you. There are even forms of therapy, such as Jungian analytic therapy or transpersonal psychotherapy, which pay a lot of attention and give a lot of respect to personal inspiration. Keep in mind that the garden variety non-LDS psychotherapist, even in Salt Lake, may know little or nothing about the interior spiritual life of Mormonism. They may know about the Seagulls and the Hoffman case and stuff like that, but they're not going to know about the stuff that we don't even talk about much among ourselves. You will need to educate your therapist concerning what is typical or accepted spiritual experience, even if rare experience, among Latter-day Saints. In some therapists, as a group, are not anti-religious, will not try to entice a Latter-day Saint to violate the moral code, will not treat spiritual experiences as firm evidences of insanity. You will find some therapists who will do one or all of these things, but it is not typical of the profession. it is worthwhile when one is going around shopping for a prospective therapist to find out about the therapist's attitude, about clients' spiritual experiences, moral values. At the same time, the LDS client must understand that therapy involves investigating values and feelings about them. Now, this leads me to the fourth myth, which I wish to consider, the myth that the basement is safe. This myth is expressed in statements like the following. Well, you know, in psychotherapy, a person talks about all sorts of unworthy desires and unpleasant episodes, which are really better off left alone rather than indulged in. And therapy focuses on things like sex and how you hated your parents. And normal people don't talk about things like that. Many people try to put certain problematic wishes or parts of their personal histories into a corner of the mental basement and lock the door on them, as if locking up something in the basement makes the rest of the house safe. But as a good many horror movies show, the house with the thing in the basement really isn't safe. What we deny, what we block out of our consciousness, what we say to ourselves didn't happen but we know really did, what we say to ourselves happened but we know really didn't, the things we have not allowed ourselves to have feelings about, all of these things gain power over us and get in the way of our stability and our development. Personal growth and healthy change may require investigating that material.
Hello, this is Mark Koltko. You're listening to the second half of a tape of a presentation which I made at the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium 12, held August 23rd, 1990, at the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah. My presentation is titled Latter-day Myths About Psychotherapy and Counseling. Unfortunately, technical difficulties at the symposium resulted in the original master tape made of my presentation being inoperable and unable to yield a good copy. I was able to donate my tape of the presentation, which was not of professional quality, to the tape reproducers, which is, so what you are listening to on the first side of this tape just happened to be a low-quality reproduction. As it happened, however, even my own tape failed to catch the second half hour of the production. So what I'm going to do is read out, as I read earlier today, the rest of my presentation, and I will give the notes that I have taken of Moin Oviatt's response. I mentioned at the end of the first side that personal growth and healthy change may require investigating difficult material. It doesn't have to be spectacular. Maybe it means facing up to the real feelings we have towards important people in our backgrounds or our present lives. In other cases, a therapist and client might have to investigate deeply painful incidents, like being a victim of child abuse. Therapy is not fun. Dealing with this material is often unpleasant, but it may be necessary to do this for the sake of the emotional and mental and spiritual health of the individual. Now you might ask, aren't there people who simply cannot face up to what has happened to them in the past? Aren't there people who will simply crumble and fall to pieces when confronting their traumatic backgrounds? Yes, there are, although they tend to show up more often on the movie of the week than in my consulting room. Part of the training of a good therapist involves learning when to uncover and when to leave well enough alone. Yes, this is scary territory. But in my experience, with proper preparation and support, people often can stand to learn more than we give them credit for. It is the preparation and support which make the difference, though, and that's largely why one goes to a professional for therapy. Now, does all this mean that therapists will force their clients to dig up all sorts of painful material, no matter what their clients came to therapy for in the first place? You know what I mean. You've probably seen the old version of the movie Miracle on 34th Street, where the kind-hearted young janitor goes to the company psychologist to have his intelligence tested for the sake of his job. And the janitor comes out of the office all confused because the psychologist has perverted a fairly straightforward purpose to a consideration of the janitor's Oedipal complex and hatred for his father, while in reality, it seems he doesn't really hate his father at all. Is this what therapists will do? No. It is a prime consideration for most therapists to focus their work on the concern for which their client came to them, through working on goals which are set mutually between the client and the therapist. These goals may change over time, but the basic nature of the relationship stays the same, working on the client's concerns. However, sometimes, working on these concerns does involve going into deep water, and it's important to keep in mind what I've said earlier about the necessity to investigate the painful. Yes, it is fearful, but it is sometimes necessary, and dealing with that fear brings me to consider the fifth myth, the myth of the vulnerable testimony. This myth reflects a fear that psychotherapy can undermine your faith. Now, to some extent, this is a reflection of the myth that psychotherapists are ungodly people, and we've talked about that earlier, but I think that this myth goes deeper than just that issue. It would be fair to say that lots of Latter-day Saints have testimonies which are based on spiritual experiences, but it would also be fair to say that many saints have social testimonies, which is to say they like being in the group, but they do not have some burning witness, and a fair number of people fall in between these categories. They remember having had experiences which felt like inspiration, but now they're coasting. And the saint may fear, what if I went to therapy and found out that I don't really have a testimony, and that I'm involved in the church for the wrong reasons? In other words, what this myth reflects is not so much a fear about therapy or therapists, but a fear about the nature of our own testimonies. Consider how much of a saint's personal identity is associated with gospel doctrines and feelings about these doctrines. A fear about the nature of one's testimony is also a fear about the nature of one's worldview, a fear about the stability of the way in which a person approaches reality, and that's quite a central issue to consider tampering with. However, if a person's testimony is shaky to start with, then it is entirely possible that therapy could help put that testimony on a firmer foundation, whether or not the therapist involved is LDS. Therapy provides a non-judgmental environment where the client is safe to explore issues at his or her own pace and without fear of social rejection. That exploration could definitely lead to a person making a firmer commitment to gospel values. If that exploration leads a person to leave the church, and I have seen this happen, then I think it highly likely that this is a decision which the person would have arrived at anyway. Although, perhaps, arriving at a decision to leave the church outside of therapy might have been arrived at in a much more painful and alienating fashion. The upshot is that psychotherapy with a responsible professional should not undermine your testimony. Therapy may well lead you to look at your testimony and its underpinnings with a more honest eye, but I see that as an advantage. The sixth and final myth which I will discuss is something I call the myth of the moral powerboat. It goes something like this. Normal people should be able to solve their problems on their own power. We're taught in the church to be self-reliant, and psychotherapy is a crutch. If you dig a little deeper at this myth, you can read the fine print that says, well, if you go to therapy, you're crazy, or mentally ill, or whatever you want to call it, but you're not normal. Going to therapy is an admission of deep-seated weakness and deficiency. I don't believe that. And part of the reason I don't believe that is because I see my own clients and why it is that they come to therapy. The other reason I don't believe that is because I've been in therapy myself. The year before I entered therapy, I had worked at a demanding full-time job and simultaneously pursued a full-time schedule of doctoral studies, at the same time earning a promotion at work, excellent grades at school, and made my first professional presentations and publications. I purchased my own home and served in a bishopric. This happens when someone is crazy, or weak, or deficient as a human being. A little hyper maybe, but not crazy. I entered therapy because in spite of these successes, in fact, maybe because of these successes, I needed help in dealing with certain other issues in my personal life, which I just couldn't afford to ignore anymore. When someone recognizes their limitations and reaches out for help, I don't call that crazy, and I don't see that as a sign that one is trying to evade responsibility. I call that a sign of a deep sanity and an attempt to take responsibility for one's life in a major way. Incidentally, you might find it interesting to know that over 70% of a national sample of psychotherapists indicated that they had been through at least one episode of personal therapy. This is not because their training required them to go through therapy. Some programs do require that, but not most. Most therapists have been in therapy themselves, I suspect, because, first, they understand that therapy does not bite, and because their own practical experience indicates that therapy is not an admission of weakness, but is a strategic move to deal with human limitation. In conclusion, I'd like to appeal to a classic and central concept of our theology, free agency. I have found, both in the lives of my clients and in my own life, that therapy can greatly help a person to exercise free agency in an intelligent, mature, and fulfilling manner. It's hard to exercise one's agency when one is under the thumb of repressed feelings or out-of-control emotions or the symptoms of distress. When appropriately pursued with a carefully chosen and skilled professional, therapy can be a powerful way to reach a higher level of responsibility, capability, and spirituality. That's the conclusion of my presentation. I do happen to have some notes on some part of Moyne Oviatt's response to my paper. The basic tack that Moyne Oviatt took was to look at each of the myths that I mentioned and make some practical applications from those myths. For example, in relation to the myth of invincible righteousness, she mentioned that my position is that we are to assume that that emotional problems are like flat tires. That goes against the Mormon grain, in the sense that Mormons like to feel that they're a peculiar people and don't have the kinds of problems of other people. We hold God hostage to our ideas of what we deserve. We feel that if we live the gospel, then we deserve to not have personal problems. And again, Moyne Oviatt mentioned that my own position is that Mormons are rather like people everywhere, in the sense that they have emotional and personal problems. Now, the question which Moyne Oviatt then went on to broach was, how do you know that you need a therapist as opposed to anyone else? And she mentioned a spectrum of reasons, starting off from very, very obvious reasons and working up to reasons which are a bit more of a judgment call. First, you know you need a therapist when one sees that one has emotional trauma related to sexual abuse. You always need professional help in these kinds of circumstances, both for the victim and for the victim's parents, if the victim is a child, or for the victim's spouse, if the victim is an adult. These are minimal requirements. Fasting and prayer don't do much for a 4-year-old rape victim. Second, you know that you need a therapist when there is conflict in a family to the extent that there is either physical separation of the marriage partners or emotional separation of the marriage partners or violence in the home. Thirdly, you know that you need a therapist when there is repeated dysfunctional behavior in the family. For example, you know, one's fourth child in the family is also the fourth child to have a teenage pregnancy. Dysfunctional behaviors show up in several members of a family on different occasions, and under those sets of circumstances, therapy is really called for. Fourth, you know you need a therapist when you see that you are the victim of compulsive behaviors or thought patterns. And this does not only involve compulsive drinking and compulsive gambling, but it also includes compulsive eating, compulsive dieting, compulsive working, compulsive shopping, compulsive exercise. How do you know, though, that a behavior is compulsive? Well, one litmus test that you can apply is that a behavior is compulsive or a thought pattern is compulsive is if you cannot not do it. If you must do some behavior or some thought pattern, even if that's a behavior or thought pattern that is approved in your group, in your culture, then it is a compulsive behavior or thought pattern. In addition, if it's the kind of thing that a person turns to make them feel better when they're feeling down, or to help them to celebrate, or just on any occasion, then it's compulsive. Fifth, therapy is called for if you have phobias. Sixth, therapy is called for if you have persistent and significant changes in mood, in your level of anxiety, in your energy level, especially if these changes in energy level cannot be attributed to symptoms of a physical illness, if there are persistent or significant changes in sleeping patterns, or eating patterns, or thinking patterns. Seventh, therapy is called for if you are liable to panic attacks. Now, to go more into areas that are a bit more nebulous and a bit more area of judgment calls, eighth, therapy is called for if you have problems in relationships that you have tried to resolve and you have not been able to resolve. And ninth, therapy is called for if you have problems in your personal life which you have tried to resolve and have not been able to resolve. Moving on to the myth of the in-house counseling staff, Moin Oviatt said that she was not sure that that it really is a part of a bishop's responsibility to give referrals. She made two important points here. One, we need to take more responsibility for getting our own referrals for counseling and psychotherapy. She mentioned that she wouldn't ask her bishop to find a pediatrician for her, so why should she expect the bishop to help her find a counselor or a psychotherapist? The second issue that she raised in relation to this myth is, where do you go for referrals? LDS Social Services is not the sole answer here. She mentioned that there's a need for therapists to educate leaders, perhaps in a workshop of 1 or 2 hours. It would be important for professional therapists to work with church leaders to go over issues like, how do you know when to refer someone for therapy? How do you recognize the symptoms of a very serious emotional distress? She also suggested that this would be a good idea for new mission presidents to go through. In relation to the myth of the ungodly therapist, Moin Oviatt mentioned that she felt that Latter-day Saints are particularly poor consumers of mental health services. Mormons assume that being a good therapist is equivalent to being an LDS therapist. We have a prejudice in terms of wanting to work with people who are just like us. But one does not go to therapy to find a soulmate. One goes to therapy to find a good professional. She also mentioned that in relation to finding a therapist, one should shop around. If one comes upon a good therapist who does not have immediate availabilities but has a waiting list, that therapist should be able to refer other good therapists. And if that therapist cannot come up with other good therapists, then one might wonder about the ego of this supposedly good therapist. Moin Oviatt did mention a number of important points to go over in ask yourself after your first meeting with a therapist. How did this therapist make you feel? Did the therapist intimidate you? How does the therapist feel about religious beliefs? Because it's entirely possible that you'll be working with a non-LDS therapist. Here again, therapy is about investigation, not about throwing pieces of the client away wholesale. So clearly one does wish to work with a therapist who can respect client religious beliefs. Moyne also mentioned, that good therapists will take the initiative to educate themselves about the religion of their clients. She mentioned that she happens to work with Baha'i clients. She knew nothing about the Baha'i religion and went to the trouble to educate herself. In relation to the myth of the safe basement, Moyne mentioned that this myth involves the issue of discovering truth. She quoted the words of Jesus Christ, who said that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. In therapy, we seek the truth in order to free our clients from the things which prevent them from being able to have happy lives. In relation to the myth of the moral power boat, Moyne mentioned that, well, you will see around town sweatshirts and t-shirts that have the motto, "Old age is not for sissies." And the same thing can be said for therapy. It's not a matter that therapy is just for the strong or the weak. Therapy is for people who wish to gain better control over their lives. This concludes the notes which I have on Moyne Oviatt's comments. Again, I regret the recording difficulties which made it difficult to give you a precise and clear recording of the events which occurred in the session. I will, however, take this opportunity to go on a little bit farther and mention some comments made to me by members of the audience after the session, which wouldn't have been on the tape anyway. One person in the audience came up to me after the presentation and said, "Well, you know, I have two more myths for you, and I'd like to see how you respond to them." Well, the first one being that psychotherapy doesn't, or psychiatry doesn't do much good. And the other myth being, psychiatrists have more personal problems than other people anyway, so how can we say that psychiatry would do any good? The way I responded to this comment was as follows. About the idea that, well, psychiatry doesn't do much good, I pointed out that there were, some years ago, some very well popularized research studies which did indicate that therapy did not have an effect. However, in the ensuing years, this research has been shown to be extremely faulty from beginning to end. That's very bad research, very poorly conducted, and badly designed. The quality research which has been performed since that time indicates that therapy can be very efficacious and very, very helpful, especially if there's a good match among the following characteristics: the personality of the therapist, the personality of the client, the theoretical outlook and method used by the therapist, and the concern which the client brings to therapy. Research indicates that we don't yet know all we need to know about why therapy works, but therapy does indeed work very frequently to a good deal, to a good extent. Concerning the second myth that he mentioned, that, well, you know, psychiatrists have more personal problems than other people, so how can we say psychiatry is any good? Well, it is the case that certain professionals do show, for example, a higher degree of suicide than the general population, and that's certainly the case with psychiatrists. However, this is the case with many professional groups. Non-psychiatric physicians have a higher rate of suicide than the general population. Some other members of the audience mentioned that dentists have a higher suicide rate than the general rate of the population. There are some problems that just go along the lines of being a professional. We don't know all the reasons behind that, but it really is silly and unfair to single out psychiatrists or therapists in this respect. The person who brought up this comment also mentioned to me that one reason why it might seem to some people in Mormon culture that psychiatry doesn't do much good is because Mormons tend to wait an awfully long time to send people to therapy, until the point where the situation has really deteriorated and it's very difficult to find any kind of solution. Another person brought up a comment to me after the session saying that he didn't see, the same way that I seem to present in my paper, a clear-cut difference between emotional health and the effects of living the gospel. And my response was, I guess what I was trying to get across, that gospel living certainly can result in mental and emotional health, and there's no dispute about that in my mind. But gospel living is not infallibly a protection against mental and emotional difficulties. And it is not the case that a solution to mental and emotional difficulties is going to be found through certain obvious gospel living principles like, you know, reading the scriptures more or praying more. It simply doesn't work like that. I thank you for your attention through this tape. Again, I apologize for the quality, and I hope that it's been some use to you. Thank you very much.